Hello, everyone. Welcome back to I See What You're Saying, the Disciplined Listening Podcast. I'm Michael Reddington, and today it is my pleasure to welcome our next guest, Frank King. Frank bills himself as the mental health comedian. As he says, he was both born to be funny and born battling mental health issues, which have plagued him his entire life. His career in comedy has taken him to many stages all around the country and led him to be one of the writers on The Tonight Show for Jay Leno. Despite all of his success in comedy, he nearly committed suicide. And now he dedicates his career to traveling and speaking and teaching audiences all around the country what it's like to feel suicidal, how we can connect with people who might be suicidal, how we can recognize it, and perhaps more importantly, how can we have the necessary conversation to keep the people we love alive and with us. This is a very powerful conversation, which he is going to add several strokes of humor to as we go through. It won't all be deep and dark, I promise, but it is going to be a powerful conversation about understanding people who really feel like that they're in insurmountable pain. And when that happens, how do we ask somebody if they're seriously considering suicide? What are three signs that somebody might be considering suicide? What is the three-legged stool of suicidality? What are the three legs of that stool? And so much more. This conversation is going to take many very important twists and turns as Frank not only shares his story, how he almost took his own life and how he's gone on to live and serve since, but there'll be so many ideas and opportunities that we can apply in our own lives should we ever run into somebody who we feel like might be headed down that tragic path. So thank you all for taking the time to listen to a very important conversation this week. While you're here, please take a second to like the show, subscribe, share the show. We truly appreciate that, especially for messages like we have today. And of course, we want to thank our sponsors, Humantel. Please head over to humantel.com and enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off the best-in-class online training to recognize what people likely might be thinking or feeling based on shifts in their facial expressions and nonverbal communication. For the professional interviewers, you can head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can learn more about the International Association of Interviewers and get all your questions answered for the Certified Forensic Interviewer designation. And while you're online, please head over to inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the programs our clients ask us to customize for their senior leaders, sales teams, negotiators, HR teams, and beyond to teach them how to apply the strategic observation and persuasive communication skills necessary to unlock hidden value in all of their high impact conversations. We appreciate you being here for another week. Thank you so very much. So now without further ado, Frank King. Good morning, Frank. It's a pleasure to meet you. I appreciate you being here today. How are you?
I'm not here voluntarily. It's all part of a plea bargain. It was jail or the discipline.
Well, I appreciate you choosing me over jail. I mean, of all the compliments I can get in the day, I had two choices, talk to you or go to jail. I chose talk to you. That's a win in my book.
I look at me. How long do you think I'd last in jail? I'd be somebody's bride before the sun went down. I'd be picking out my China pattern before the number was dry on my shirt. I'd be face down on a bunk before you could say conjugal visit. I'd be putting on the cherry Kool-Aid lipstick daily.
Well, I'll keep you here with me as long as I can to ensure that none of those things happen. Well, we've already started out on a humorous tip, and I know comedy is a big part of your background. And one of the things that struck me when I was learning about you was a specific quote that you had, which I think is potentially an unexpected, but hopefully an eye-opening way to open up our conversation. So you refer to yourself as a dead man talking.
Right.
And with that as a backdrop, a question I never thought I would ask anybody, how does the barrel of a gun taste?
Well, on that day, having filed Chapter 7 bankruptcy, devastating my wife, lost everything, it tasted like relief. A lot of people don't understand that most people who die by suicide don't want to die. They just want to end the pain. And I could end the pain and had $1 million life insurance policy, so I could restore my wife financially and end the pain in 1 3-pound trigger pull. So the problem was I had sold insurance straight out of college. I knew every life insurance policy has at least a 2-year suicide clause. Kill yourself in less than 24 months, they return your premiums. After 24 months, she gets $1 million. Called my agent. Asked him how long I'd had the policy. He said 22 months and don't do it. Because he had this conversation and delivered checks to the beneficiaries. So that's the genesis of the, and it's in my keynotes. It's in the first two or three minutes when I keynote. And I get busted by a psychologist after a keynote once. He goes, you know, you're not a psychologist. You're not a psychiatrist, not even a therapist. What qualifies you to talk about, you know, suicide prevention? I said, well, I can tell you what the barrel of my gun tastes like. And in the silence that followed, I said, look, Chief, I could go to college and learn absolutely everything you know. You will never know everything I know. That's what qualifies me.
And to me, when I saw that in leading up to this conversation, that was one of the things that really grabbed me. And I appreciate your willingness to share it with what you do, especially in this conversation today. There's, and I guess in any discipline, there's a balance between, you know, the academic and the practitioner, and that's a whole nother conversation. But you raised several good points there. For people who talk about mental health, there's different ways to approach it. But unless somebody has had the barrel of the gun in their mouth, there's a set of understanding, there's a set of experiences, a set of emotions and decisions that are there. And one of the things that grabbed me, even as you were giving the short synopsis of that day, was that, yes, there was an emotional component, and I'd love to get back to that, wanting the pain to go away. But there was also a very rational component. You knew how many months were on the life insurance policy. You had the foresight to call your agent just to double check, who thankfully picked up what you were putting down and had some words of caution for you. But so there was that balance of the emotional and the rational as you were going through it. So what I think this is a very important question for anybody to listen to the answer. Parents, friends, business people, doesn't matter, whoever you're speaking with, if somebody is feeling so much pain that they just want the pain to end and they're willing to do anything to make it end, up into the worst, looking from the outside in, from your experience, how can we begin to connect with somebody who is in that much pain that they're willing to do anything to make it go away?
I think, first off, they should understand that one of the three legs of the three-leg stools of suicidality is burdensomeness. You feel like you're a burden to the world, to your family, to your friends. You hear people say, didn't he consider what the impact would be on, you know, his friends and family? As a matter of fact, they probably did, and they probably thought, you know, I'm dragging them down. My mom and dad, I put them through, you know, they'll be better off without me. So it actually, from the inside looking out, is selfless, and outside looking in is selfish. If somebody is suffering that badly, the simple thing to do and the protocol is ask them, are you having thoughts of suicide? Just like that. And there's an old wives' tale that you should never mention the word suicide in front of somebody who's depressed, because it might give them the idea. Suicide? What a great idea. Why didn't I think of that? Trust me, it crossed my mind. So, and in fact, if you mention it out loud, it reduces the chances that they're going to die by suicide. So you ask them, are you having thoughts of suicide? Now, if they're not forthcoming, but your gut tells you they're circling the drain, I always say go with your gut. How would you know? Well, they talk about death and dying a lot. They Google death, dying, or how to die by suicide. Death and dying appears as a theme in their music, artwork, writing. They're getting their affairs in order, especially if they're giving away prized possessions. They want to make sure the possessions go to the people they want them to go to when they're gone. And here's a counterintuitive one that people need to watch out for. They've been depressed for a long time, and now they're happy for no apparent reason. Well, they may be happy because they know the pain is coming to an end. So you got to be very careful. But let's say they do tell you they're having thoughts of suicide. What do? You ask them simply, do you have a plan? And if they have a plan, okay, what is your plan? If it's detailed time, place, and method, you need to do your best to get them to a mental health facility simply for evaluation. Or at very least, calling 988. And if they won't pick up the phone and call 988, I suggest you pick up the phone, call 988. The volunteer will do their best to talk the phone into the hand of the person who is in crisis. Now, here's something I've never seen in any book, in any course I've taken, What if they got a plan, but it's not particularly detailed? What do you say? A psychiatrist and I came up with this. If it's not detailed, I would say, okay, well, tell me, you're going to kill yourself? And if they said no, I would say, okay, tell me why not. Make them give voice to whatever is keeping, because something is keeping them here. Otherwise, you wouldn't be having this conversation. Mm-hmm. So that's the protocol. If you have young people, kids, yours or somebody else's, and they're struggling. I talk about this when I know there are parents in the audience who have kids who are struggling. I say, look, don't say this. You have so much to live for. As someone who's lived with suicidality for 60 years, that won't even put a dent in it. What I think you should do is join the conversation in their head. I believe you should say, look, I know it's probably crossed your mind that you're a burden to your mom and me, and that we'd be better off without you. Let me tell you something. In no uncertain terms, are you a burden to us? And in no uncertain terms, would we be better off without you? And I told that story in Vegas in February of 23 at a speaker academy or something. I was talking about how to get a TEDx, and somehow I lapsed into my suicide prevention stuff. And I was talking to a gentleman who threw that event last week. We were on the same panel, and I'd done mine. He was getting ready to do his. He goes, wait, Frank, before you leave, I got to tell you, there was a guy in the audience at that event, a father whose son was struggling, and he reached out to me after all was said and done and said, if you ever talk to Frank again, tell him thank you, because I think he helped me save my son's life. And I'm guessing it was probably that piece of advice right there. You want to join the conversation that the kid, young person's having in their head.
I think that's a great point. Join the conversation that they're having in their head.
Yep.
Very good point. And not being afraid to ask them about it, it's, I can make maybe not quite appropriate analogies, even thinking back into my career in investigations. You know, you don't want to bring up the topic of fraud or stealing or how they might do it or how they might commit the crime. Well, believe me, if they are doing it or if they're considering doing it, I'm not the first person that has put this idea in their head. So it actually gives me some potential paths forward. So to hear you use that same line of logic here, although I don't have the experience in this particular field, it certainly resonates with me. If they've thought about it, they've thought about it. Me bringing it up is not going to be, almost certainly not going to be what puts them over the line. In fact, it could bring it the other direction.
And with that in mind, when I speak, I took a course called QPR, Question, Persuade, Refer, QPRinstitute.com. It's a suicide prevention curriculum. And before they will graduate you, you have to promise that when you use any of their materials, their slide deck, or talk about their, you have to allow 30 minutes when you're done for individual conversations. Because when I do my keynote, I have a general Q&A. I go, look, if you have something you want to ask or a story you want to tell and you don't want to do it in front of everybody, like, hey, Frank, I'm crazy. Can you help me? I'll take the conversation afterwards. We'll just, you know, I'll hang around 30, 45 minutes. And there's always a line. Sometimes two people, sometimes 10. And I think it's because by being honest about my experiences and my, you know, I came close to dying. I have two mental illnesses. There are more nuts in my family than in a squirrel turd, that they feel it gives them permission to give voice. Most of the conversations start like this. I've never told anybody this. Really, I get that a lot. May I give you the most dramatic it ever got?
Sure.
I was in Cincinnati and I was doing a suicide prevention keynote on site at a construction site for a very large construction company in Cincinnati. And when I got done, there was a line and the audience was mostly men because construction is male heavy. And half a dozen people, the last guy in line was a black guy, probably mid-20s. And when he gets to me, he's crying so hard he can't speak. So I waited. And I said, when he gathered himself, what's up? He goes, well, I haven't slept in two nights. I work on the fifth floor of this building, and I think about jumping off every day. I said, why is that? He said, because I've lost three people close to me in the last year to violence, including my daughter who died in my arms. How'd you like somebody to pull the pin on that grenade drop in your lap? Yeah. So the HR guy who hired me wasn't far away, so I waved him over. I said, look, you need to find the EAP, Employee Assistance Program binder. Find the closest mental health facility to where you're standing right now. Take this nice young man by the hand and get him there immediately because he's circling the drain. And so a couple months later, I was having a conversation on another topic with the HR guy, and I'm terrified to ask. Finally got up my nerve and go, hey, whatever happened to the nice black guy who was the carpenter? He said, Frank, he was evaluated, medicated, he's back on the job. There's a little ROI for you.
For sure. For sure. And hopefully they're careful of which floor he's on while there.
And you know what? I bet none of his workmates knew anything about that. I bet the majority of his family had no idea he was struggling. But because I was on stage, because I was honest, you know, and I was vulnerable, and he knew I wouldn't judge, he felt comfortable enough to come up and you know, for a guy to share like that. You know, guys don't usually share that kind of thing.
Nope.
Which is why 8 out of 10 suicides in the U.S. currently are men, because we don't generally reach out for help. So anyway, I was touched that he reached out, and I was delighted he was still alive.
And thank you for that, not just for sharing the story, but for saving that man's life, among many others, I'm sure, through your work. But that is, you use the phrase most dramatic. I'll go with that. That might be the most dramatic example of a great way to get somebody to open up with you is for you to be open up about a mistake you made or something you'd like to have back first. That's true as a parent. That's true as a leader trying to teach somebody how to do something else. That's true if you're in negotiations or sales. Like there hopefully won't be a more dramatic example than that.
Yeah.
If we can open up ourselves, here's a mistake, here's a regrettable decision statement, something I'd like to have back, something I learned from, then it's, assuming it's real, then it's easier for people to come back. So that's a tremendous example. Earlier, you mentioned the three-legged stool of suicidality, and you talked about the burdensomeness.
Yeah.
May I ask for the other two legs?
Yes. One is you have decided you can do it. I mean, from birth, we struggle to live. You know, even as an infant, we struggle to live. So you decided you can cross that barrier. And the other one is generally just social distancing, not like COVID, but move away. My wife was cashier at a grocery store for a long time. And she's one of those people, when she says, how you doing at the cash register, they know she means how you doing, not just, it's not perfunctory. So the woman, and this happened to her frequently, a woman just burst into tears. And so Wendy said, well, you know, what's up? And she said, well, my daughter moved away. My daughter was living with depression, suicidality, moved away, moved all the way across the country. We're in Oregon, moved to Florida. She bought a gun and she killed herself. And so my wife said, would you mind calling her? And maybe you can help her find a grief group or something. So I called her and I said, listen, I'm happy to help you, you know, find a group that's appropriate. But first of all, have you reached out to other, you know, sources of comfort? I said, are you a churchgoer? And I'm not particularly religious, but if somebody is, I leverage that. She goes, yeah, I go to, you know, church on Sundays, Bible study on Wednesdays. Great. I said, and have you broached this subject with a minister? And she said, yes. And I said, fearing what I was about to hear, I said, well, how did that go? She goes, well, he's relatively new. And when I told him what had happened, he said, it's all part of God's plan. Okay, now, before I could stop my hillbilly self, Michael, I said, part of God's plan, really? You know, apparently I missed that fucking meeting. And she laughed for the first time in 8 months. Somebody finally validated that maybe it wasn't part of God's plan. I know the young man meant well, but it's just sometimes, you know, it's just like, I just, you know, hopefully by being able to laugh out loud, it began her recovery. I'm sure it was still very painful, but at least somebody agreed with her that it wasn't, you know, and I'm not omnipotent. Maybe it was part of God's plan. I don't know. But in the moment I thought, you know, that's, so.
Yeah. And when I think about trying to help people with mental health and then And you could put in even survivors of those who unfortunately have crossed the line, because although it might fall into different categories, they now have very real mental health issues as well as they try to cope with somebody who has left their life.
Yep.
There is the trying to connect with them up front and trying to help them the best we can. And for most of us, and I would say myself very much included, we're ill-equipped with how to do that, even with our best efforts. And then on the consoling side, I'm somebody that talks for a living, unfortunately, and the number one time where I have no idea what to say is if I'm trying to console somebody who has just experienced something tragic. Like that is the fastest way that I have. I know there are no right words. So how do I try to say something or do something? So to your point, we can understand necessarily where people are trying to come from. They're trying to help. But, yeah. You know, what do we do and how do we get there? You mentioned that might have been the first time that she laughed out loud.
Yeah.
Part of your journey. God, that's a word that gets used a whole lot of different ways these days. But part of your journey post sampling the barrel of a gun has been humor. How has humor in your path to comedy helped you with your mental health issues that you mentioned earlier, as well as helped you connect with other people?
Actually, and I get that question a lot. You know, is comedy therapeutic for you? No. My family, my grandmother died by suicide. My mother found her. My great aunt died by suicide. My mother and I found her. I was 4 years old. I screamed for days. And I mean, it was horror movie horrible when it happened. And I warned the audience before I tell them a story. Look, if you're easily triggered, you might want to step out of the foyer now for about the next 2 minutes as I give you the details of this, you know, me and my mother and I finding my great aunt. And pretty much everybody in our family has three things. High cholesterol. My mother has had the cholesterol of a deep fat fryer. Mental illness. And we're funny. The whole family is funny. And so they're actually two separate things. And it's never therapeutic, you know, for me. It was perhaps a defense mechanism when you're young and you're getting picked on, you know, and you can be funny and, you know, they tend to leave you alone. But yeah, I've never used it as therapy. I knew from fourth grade that I was going to be a comedian. I told a joke, kids laughed, teacher was hysterical. She was laughing so hard she had to go to the teacher's lounge. Because I asked her later when I bumped into her years later, why'd you go to the teacher's lounge, Frank? That was the funniest thing a child ever said to me before or since. And I was afraid if I laughed that hard, you might misinterpret it. And it would, you know, it would break your heart and your spirit. And then she said, what are you doing for a living now? And I said, stand-up comedy.
Funny she, you should ask.
Duh. Yeah. So in fourth grade in Ms. Dark's class, I decided I'm going to be a comedian. 12th grade, I'd been taking drama 3 years, never got a speaking role in any of the school plays. And I thought, I see a pattern. So they mentioned we have a talent show in spring semester senior year. Okay. I thought if I do stand up, I can write, direct, produce, and star in my own little show every night. So I did stand up. Nobody ever done stand up before at the talent show. There's a picture of me in the yearbook in a really ugly three-piece suit with a microphone. And I won. Of course, I beat the accordion player and the folk dancer. It's not a, you know, big victory, but still. And I said to my mom, we're going to L.A. And she said, son, you're going to college first. I don't care what you do when you get done. You can be a goat herder for all I care. But you are going to be a goat herder with a college degree. So I went to UNC Chapel Hill, picked up a couple of degrees, and then bolted for the West Coast. Now, first open mic night, which, by the way, just by coincidence, April 1st, 84. So here we are in almost April in 2024. So April 1st of this year, be 40 years since the day I stepped up on stage at open mic night. And halfway through my little set, I heard a voice inside my head that said, you're home. Whoa. So I decided for real, I was going to do it for a living. I had no idea how. 18 months later, said to my girlfriend, now my wife of 37 years, I'm going on the road to be a comic full time. You want to come along for the ride? Figured she'd go, hell no. She goes, yeah. So we gave up our apartment, our jobs, and we were on the road for 2,629 nights in a row, nonstop, 7 years and change. And yeah, world's longest nonstop comedy club road trip, and then a little radio, and then corporate comedy. And, you know, and I always, Michael, wanted to make a living and a difference, because I joined the National Speaker Association in 95, and everybody had content. Everybody's making a difference. And I just could never figure out what I had to teach anybody. So after I put a gun in my mouth, and after the recession began to ease and people started meeting again, conferences, meeting planners said, "Frank, look, we love you. We can't pay you $5,000 anymore just to be funny. You got to teach them something." What? And there's a book called The Message of You, Turn Your Life into a Money-Making Speaking Career. A friend of mine wrote, she gave me a copy. So, "Frank, read it. You'll figure it out." I went into it thinking I got nothing. And then halfway through, I thought, son of a bitch, I do have something to talk about. You know, given my mental illness, near suicide, my family, I could keynote on suicide prevention. And then the other hurdle, Michael, was, well, yeah, but you've been doing stand-up for 2.5 decades. Who's going to take you seriously? So that's when my wife suggested a TEDx. And I said, what's a TEDx? Just so happened I got an application that week from a TEDx in Canada. Filled it out, sent it in, got the audition, and got it. And then two more call me, two more TEDx events. "Do you have any more mental health topics?" "Yeah." And I'm getting ready to do my 13th one April 10th, which is in what, 4 weeks, 3 weeks? And then I just got an audition for number 14, TEDx Gainesville. I think they might book me for that one because the title is "Mental Health and the Orgasm: Treat Your Depression Single-Handedly."
I feel like comedy would fit in there.
Yes. The tagline is, "I love my iPhone, but it's my second favorite handheld device." So I think that's what got me, because, you know, they get 300 applications easy. And so sure. I tell my students, you have to break through the clutter. You've got to have a hook. You got to have some reason for them to stop and go, "What?" Orgasm? What the hell? What? So
when you switched over, actually, let me take a step even back behind that. You wanted to help. You wanted to teach people. So yeah. You were looking for the opportunity to mesh your comedic chops, being able to be in front of a room, connect with audiences, move them emotionally, but also teach them something. So yeah. Now the suicide prevention thing starts to work. You get the first of now almost 14 TEDx's. You parlay that into your speaking career, up to and including saving the lives of guys on construction sites. So when you are setting out to teach people at your speaking events about suicide prevention, from your perspective, what are the most important things you want them walking away learning?
Well, I tell them after I give them the statistics, you know, every year in the United States, I think it's 8 million people seriously consider suicide, 1.4 million attempt. And this last year we have numbers for 49,000 change died by suicide. Then I say, here's the good news, that people who are suicidal, 8 out of 10 are ambivalent. They haven't made up their mind. They can't make up their mind. And 9 out of 10 give hints in the last week leading up to an attempt. 9 out of 10. So which means, and I say to the audience, that means you can make a difference. You can save a life. And you can do it by doing something as simple as what we're doing right here, and that is having a conversation if you know how. And before you leave here, you will know how. It's a Donald Miller build a story brand idea.
Mm-hmm.
Thing is, make the audience the hero in the piece. I'm not sure. There to save lives. I'm there to empower them. So I teach them the signs and symptoms, depression, thoughts of suicide, what to say and not to say, what to do, what not to do, how to find resources. So by the time we get done, and I pass out individually wrapped wintergreen, you can buy them on Amazon, wintergreen lifesavers. So everybody's got a wintergreen lifesaver individually wrapped. And so I say, you're probably wondering about those, that candy, when I get almost done. I said, well, those are lifesavers, and now you are too. Mic drop.
Bring it all together. We haven't talked too much about what the don't say's or do's yet, and we probably should touch on that. But before we do, I want to circle back. You talked for the, like, let's focus on the positive first. What should we do? You talked about asking, are you committing suicide? Are you thinking about committing suicide? You talked about having the joining the conversation in their head, certainly getting them help. Especially if they say that they have a plan. So we've talked about some of those things. One of the things that jumped out to me was looking for pattern breaks. So they've been really sad. All of a sudden, they're really happy. I think that one's crucial. That's an enormous pattern break that from a hopeful person, who a hopeful observer who wants to believe that they're better, can interpret that as they're better when that actually could be the final step. So I think that one was enormous to call out. So what are some other potential pattern breaks or behaviors or alert signals that we haven't talked about yet that we should be looking for, and other great first steps to connect with people?
Because people ask, and my top three signs of depression, these obviously not an exhaustive list, but just the three I tend to talk about. One is they have trouble getting out of bed in the morning. So they're often late for school or work. However, come the afternoon, they rally like a different person. Two, they let their personal hygiene go. So normally they're pretty well put together, but you know, last couple of weeks, clothes dirty, hair not quite so clean. It may be because they're having trouble getting out of bed in the morning to run a load of wash, take a shower. And also, if they eat too much or they can't eat, they sleep too much or they cannot sleep is another, I would say, top three symptom. And again, you're looking for patterns. You have to listen. You know, I use a military analogy. If a North Korean plane strays over the border between North and South Korea and then back, and it's a one-off, okay, well, you know, the pilot just, you know, got lost, you know. But if it happens, you know, once is an accident, twice is a pattern, three is a lifestyle. So you're looking for patterns. And you also have to take things they say seriously. For example, if somebody says, yeah, well, this company's not going to have to worry about me after the weekend. Okay, sounds pretty innocuous. Maybe they're going back to college. Maybe they're getting another job. Maybe they're just quitting. But maybe they're thinking about ending their lives. They don't have to worry about me anymore. So sometimes you need to dig a little deeper and go, wait. What do you mean they won't have to worry about you? You got another job? You're going back to school? What's up? So things that can sound really innocuous after you realize that they're not or cannot, may not be, that my job is to work with people, speak to people, teach them to recognize the signs and symptoms. So once they've learned it, they can't unlearn it. And once they've heard me talk about that, then they hear somebody goes, yeah, they're not going to have to worry about me after this weekend. Okay, hold on just a second. Let's unpack that a bit. And again, that's that 9 out of 10 giving hints in the last week leading up to an attempt is something like that, where they say something that sounds kind of innocuous, but in fact, they may be planning to check out.
It has real meaning to it. And when you talk about that listening, observation, looking for patterns, we're talking about it now at the most drastic edge, somebody looking at taking their life. But again, parents, friends, coworkers, spouses, whomever, identifying patterns in people's behavior, identifying breaks in patterns in people's behavior can help us identify lots of potential problems, issues, or maybe even good things that are changing in their life at an earlier time where we can have a bigger impact, as opposed to, it's better to catch it in the last week than to not catch it at all, for sure. But as opposed to letting it go that long, outside of what we already talked about, the asking them, are they thinking about it? Do they have a plan? Those types of things, get the conversation in their head. Are there any other important to-dos? Get them help. You've already mentioned call 988. You've already mentioned QPR. Certainly we'll put some of these. I can even go online and grab suicide prevention hotline links. I'll put them in here for people. Yeah. So they're all there. But outside of those that we've already talked about, are there any other to-dos that are very high on your list before we talk about the to-don'ts?
Yes. If somebody you believe is depressed, or they tell you they're depressed, the to-do, I believe, is you say to them, look, I'm here for you and I mean it. I know that depression is a mental illness. I know you're not lazy, crazy, or self-absorbed. I know that with time and treatment, things will get better. I will take the time. I'll help you get the treatment. to get better. And of course, you have to mean it. And people ask all the time, what should I say? Well, how about not saying anything? How about just listening actively? Just ask leading questions, sit back and listen. And don't do the listening if you're not in a good place physically or mentally. If you're sick, like with a flu, that's not a good time because you may hear some really disturbing things. And if you're not 100% mentally and physically to be ready for that. So, and a quiet place where nobody can overhear you. And I would say, don't book another appointment or whatever backed up to this conversation. You know, I really like to continue talking about you killing yourself, but I've got to, you know, that is what I would say is I'm here. I'm here to help you and I'll help you get the treatment you need.
And you talked earlier too, suspending judgment. So as we're listening, trying to control those facial expressions, those body reactions, nonverbal reactions, so we don't inadvertently shut somebody down. One of the things that I can imagine is hard for people who haven't been, you know, what it's like to be consumed by pain. They've never had anybody try to connect through the fog that this pain has created for them. So instead of going the way of trying to help somebody understand what the level of pain rises to that could cause somebody to want to take their life, because honestly, I don't know that people can really understand that if they haven't been there. Let's go the other way. What are some of the well-intentioned to don'ts that we should get off the list right now so we don't inadvertently make things worse?
Well, the people say, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. That's hard to do if you're hanging from a rafter. That's my little bit of humor there. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps, turn that frown upside down. My personal favorite, have you tried fish oil? At which point I go from suicidal to homicidal. Also, if you're going to talk to them about this, if you're going to, you know, try to help them, I would suggest you don't bring judgment, obviously, but also don't bring your religious beliefs to the meeting. Like I said, I am not particularly religious, but I ask somebody in this situation, are you strong in Christ? Yes. I go to church on Sundays. I go to Bible study. Well, what do you say? What do you say you and me and your minister get together and form a team and tackle this? I mean, I'm willing to do anything. What you don't do is say, you know, if you kill yourself, you're going to hell. Even if you firmly believe that, unless the other person firmly believes that. My next door neighbor, shortly after I put the gun in my mouth, said to me, you know, if you'd pulled the trigger, you'd gone to hell. And I said, you know what? I was already there. I'm sure he meant well, but yeah. So don't bring your religiosity, your theology, your judgment, just park that and meet them where they are.
I imagine that for many people, I'll take a step back. Often in life, again, to come several steps away from this far edge of the suicide conversation, we feel like by bringing up consequences, we will change people's behavior because they want to avoid the consequences. That ends up being untrue way more often than it's true, regardless of how we are operationally conditioned to speak. But now, especially here, if we already have somebody who is willing to, who the pain has become so severe that all they're focused on is getting rid of that pain, then my assumption is there are no rational consequences that will change their mind. You'll hurt your family. Well, like you said, I'm already a burden to my family. It'll be a relief. You'll go to hell. I'm already in hell. You'll regret it. I'll be dead, actually. I won't be regretting anything. So getting back to that point of when somebody is dealing with this overwhelming pain that is literally taking over their entire being, we might have good intentions by using a consequence. Don't do this or else. But not only will it fall on deaf ears, my guess is it could be accidentally more motivating to them because all the consequence could do is add to the insurmountable pain I'm already feeling. So I may as well erase the pain. Besides bringing the religiousness to it, what are some other well-intentioned mistakes that people who really love somebody make in those stressful moments at the end trying to pull somebody out?
Well, we talked about with young people. You know, I tell parents, what you don't say to a young person is, but honey, you've got so much to live for. Won't put a dent in it. It's not about that. you know, it's a, yeah. And I'm sure they understand at some level, the child does, that they do have a lot to live for, but they're in a great deal of pain. They feel like a burden to the folks. They probably already made the decision they can do it. And so I think if you can get somebody to simply agree to be evaluated, you know, is it garden variety depression? Is it the depressive state of bipolar, which is far more dangerous? Is it schizoaffective disorder? Also, I recommend you have a full physical, blood work and all. Sometimes physical ailments present as mental health symptoms. There's a guy here I know in Eugene who was terribly depressed, and he had it all had to work up physically, and it turns out his body was not metabolizing iron properly. So they put him on a time-released iron supplement, and the depression disappeared. So I would say physical, you know, and if you're taking a medication that's not working, a psychotropic medication, about a third of them work really well for some people. A third work okay for that same group, and a third are horrible. So there's now a DNA cheek swab test. They take your DNA and they try to match it to the antidepressant, let's say, that works best with your personal metabolism. So it shrinks the list of possibilities of drugs down to two or three, because the doctor really only knows what the drug salesman told him. Yeah, so go ahead and get the test, figure out how it matches up with your... That way you get a lot less of the experimentation. Go on, doesn't work, taper off. Go on, doesn't work, taper off. That roller coaster is really dangerous. So, yeah, I think get them evaluated, if at all possible.
All good. And I would imagine I'm not imagining this part. Every person is different. Every situation is different. How people deal with mental health is going to be different. There's not only is there not one brush, there's probably not a million brushes to cover all of the differences. But for people, actually, let me throw this out as a question instead of a statement. Do you see it, if we want to get somebody into evaluation, but they're resistant, can understand a million reasons why they might be resistant, would offering, why don't we commit to an evaluation to demonstrate that there isn't an issue? There's a better way to say that. But if would that potentially be an avenue to somebody that's resistant? Instead of saying, in so many words, let's go get an evaluation so we can find out exactly what the problem is and fix it. If we flip that with some people sometimes to let's go get the evaluation so we can just check off that there isn't an issue, do you see that as a potentially viable approach on the right occasion with the right person? So at least we're getting the evaluation and hopefully can arrive at a path to an outcome, or am I just wishful thinking?
No, I think that's valid. I during an ice storm we had here last year, February, I think, I had to drive into town to get internet because the lines were down, and I had to drive into town to get propane for the generator, and I was exhausted. And I'm coming home, and I rolling up on stoplights that are off, and nobody's brake lights were on. So I didn't register that I was going to be going through an intersection. All of a sudden, to my left, I'm in a Sequoia tank, and there's this little Subaru Outback coming this way. So I realized if I hit him, I was going to kill him. So I just said, fuck it, and spun the wheel. And I took out a walk, don't walk. And the Subaru never even slowed down. The airbag didn't even go off. But my wife is concerned, because I'm 68, that maybe it was a cognitive issue. You know, maybe I was slipping cognitively. So she said, will you take a cognitive test? And I said, sure. If only to eliminate that as a cause of that accident. And thank God I passed it with 100%. But it relieved her mind. It relieved my mind. That wasn't the issue. I was just exhausted. And I mean, as exhausted as I was, in that split second when I caught that car coming from my left, I was able to make that split second decision. Fuck it. Spin the wheel. Total the Sequoia. Jacked my insurance up twice what it was before. But I had the presence of mind. I don't want to kill him. So, but yeah, that she said, would you take it a cognitive test? Sure. Just if nothing else, just to eliminate that as a possibility.
It could work. If it works one time with one person, then amen. You talked about young people, and I feel like suicide is always scary. It's always tragic. There's no two ways around that. I feel like in many ways, the younger somebody is, the more tragic and the more scary it is for any number of reasons. And you said you have a lot to live for, future ahead, all of these other things. One of the things I heard you say was helping his parents or whomever convince somebody that you're not a burden, that we're better off with you here, all of these things. What are helpful techniques that you have seen to help instill that belief in people we care about, hopefully before they ever become depressed or before they ever, God forbid, find themselves in the deep end where they think about these types of acts? I mean, we can tell our kids all the time, I love you. You're the best part of my life. We can spend time with them. And as parents, we should be consistently doing those things. And as spouses, we should be consistently doing those things anyway, just because we love them. But have you in particular seen the power or seen specific examples of doing that in order to avoid ever having to deal with the suicide situation or be more successful dealing with the suicide situation because of the work we did up front?
Yes. And for young people, I think part of the problem is I've been dealing with the depression. It's about a 3-day cycle, 72 hours. I cycle down the first day, flatten out the second, come back up the third. And I've been through that cycle so many times. But I know as I'm cycling down, okay, well, you know, I'm just going to ride it out. I used to say that I fight it, but fight implies I can win. I can't win. It's in my DNA. You know, I can lose and kill myself, or it's kind of like North and South Korea, kind of an uneasy truce. So I just ride it like a wave, figuring it's going to break here in about 72 hours. I'll be fine. But young people don't have that advantage. And young people often think in the immediate. Mm-hmm. Life is not going to get any better than this. And I don't think it is. Then, so we have to convince them that it will get better, you know, over time. And that, I think, open communication with kids, young people, is the key. I can't tell you how many parents have come up to me and said, yeah, my son came to me and said he was depressed and never thought suicide. Well, count yourself blessed. Because I also know other people who don't know any of that until they come home and they find them hanging from the rafters. And there was a woman who speaks on suicide prevention, and that happened with her son. And he was a musician, and he had a notebook he carried around with him where he wrote his, you know, lyrics and music, but he would never set it down anywhere. He would take it to the bathroom with him. Turns out, because he didn't want his mom to see it. Because when he passed away and she got hold of the notebook and you're flipping the pages, I mean, you can just see it coming. So I think opening up that line of communication, and parents, you know, they don't want their kid to be flawed in any way. So sometimes they have difficulty, you know, they want them to be okay and you know, and mentally healthy and physically healthy. And so they're sometimes shy about starting a conversation. Because again, there's an old wives' tale. Starting a conversation may make them more likely, actually make them less likely, but it's a difficult conversation to have. So communication being the key, really listening to the child, not poo-pooing it. Oh, yeah, but you know, everybody has trouble in high school. Not like this. There was a woman I know who wrote a book on narcolepsy. That she had that, but she didn't know for a long time. She thought everybody got that tired until she went to a sleep doctor and goes, honey, this is a different kind of tired. So, and with young people, you often hear them say, I'm tired. It could be tired physically, could be soul exhaustion. Adults say the same thing. Look, I'm just tired. Could be the same thing. Could be they're physically exhausted. Could be they're just tired of living. And young people often are what they call passively suicidal, especially if there's been childhood trauma. They think to themselves, you know, I would never kill myself, but if I didn't wake up tomorrow morning, that'd be fine. So that's passive suicidality. Hopefully it never morphs into active suicidality. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people who, you know, I've got a friend, she goes, I feel like killing myself, but here's the problem, Frank. I don't like guns and I hate heights. I go, well, we're just going to have to figure out another way. And she's had several attempts with pills. And fortunately didn't, you know, she survived. But yeah, I think trying to be trying to keep the communication lines open with the kids and having difficult conversations and tell them, look, there's nothing you can't tell me that, you know, change the way I feel about you. So please, you know, if you're maybe even have a conversation, you know, especially if another child, teenager in high school dies by suicide, be a good time for the parents to use that to open the conversation. You know, I just want to, well, let's talk about that. You know, it's maybe have them tell their parents what they knew about this young person and then open the conversation. Well, listen, you know, if you ever feel that way, please, you know, let's talk about it.
Yeah, that open communication piece you talked about, I mean, it's clearly critical. And you talked about how parents don't want their children to be flawed and they don't want to experience some of the emotions and with that. But it's one thing to tell somebody that you can tell me anything, especially your own child. It's another thing to create opportunities to prove it. Yeah. So starting from the time that they're young and, you know, kind of like somebody asked you, well, what expertise do you have in talking about suicide? Well, you know, for me, what expertise do I have in talking about kids? Well, I can certainly reflect back on my childhood and why I did or didn't talk to my parents. I can certainly look at my experience as a parent so far, friends, family, you know, just the psychology, things we learned in investigating that are carry over way more than people would realize. But starting young and not just keeping the open dialogue, but keeping it consistently, keeping it even about seemingly small or minimal things, not punishing people for telling you the truth. Kids can have punishments for their actions, but not for telling you the truth. You know, we got to keep those separate as we go through. And then back to your story in the beginning about why people open up to you because you're vulnerable first. So when I'm talking with my son, being judicious about it, considering age and mentality and context and emotional development and all those things, but sharing stories about mistakes that I made and experiences I had and when I was sad or when I was frustrated or all these things, that builds the trust equity in him where hopefully, God forbid, down the road when the tough times come as a teenager, he is more willing and open to talk to his mom and I because we were laying the foundation, the whole time, as opposed to waiting to, well, okay, now something happened at school. Yes, we definitely need to talk about it. But this is the first time we're trying to have that open communication, you know, to make, I guess, a biblical reference, you know, when did Noah build the ark? Before it rained. So if I'm already wet and now I'm trying to build a boat, I'm not saying don't try to build the boat. We still need it, but we probably should have started earlier. And especially with young people, that's so critical. I'd like to kind of flip the conversation on its head for a second with the last few minutes that we have here. You've talked openly about some of the mental health struggles you have, and I really am grateful for that. Are there any ways where you feel like your mental health struggles have given you advantages or superpowers or created other opportunities for you that other people might not have?
Yes. I believe my suicidality is a coping mechanism. Things get stressful. It's always on the menu as an option. Solution, problems large and small. And I tell the audience, look, this is how small it is. Car broke down a couple of years ago. I had three thoughts, unbidden. One, get it fixed. Two, buy a new one. Three, I could just kill myself. That's just, you know, it's like the brain going, I got an idea. You're not going to like it. But it is and people say, I have a funeral director friend who says when people start talking after they've lost somebody about maybe taking their own life, I ask them to take suicide off the table. And I said, no. Don't take it off the table, just move it to one side. Because what you've done, if you take it off the table, is there's no way out. So they take the only way out. Let's just move it aside for now. Yeah, and my suicidality is like that. I've said more than once, if it weren't for my chronic suicidality, the fact that I could do it anytime, you know, I choose, I would have done it a long time ago. But I know I have the option. If the pain gets too bad, you know, I made a mistake on the way back from Cambodia after I worked a cruise at the beginning of the pandemic. And people thought I had come back from the Far East dragging a virus. And so a guy called me and he goes, I know where you work out and know when you work out. I'm coming to kill you. I said, okay. So as you're doing your mental math, you might want to add this in. I've been trying to kill myself for 60 years. And I'm not afraid to die. I don't want to. but I'm not afraid of it. So do you really want to come and take on a guy who has absolutely nothing to lose? And you know, it never showed up. So it's, you know, it's, well, and we had a fire, we had a wildfire here, and we were evacuated. I was downtown when, I don't know if you're familiar with this, but they have like a three-stage, you know, get ready. So that means pack your bag, get set, put everything in the car along with the animals, go. Okay, so when I left home, it was a one, get ready. I'm downtown, my phone goes off. It's jumped to three. It's like, get out now. Well, we have rescue cats. I think we had 10 rescue cats at the time in that house, in the path of the fire. So as everybody else is driving out, I'm driving in. I drive in, I go in the garage, I pull the garage door down because there are police in the neighborhood with a, you know, bullhorn. Get out, get out, get out. I didn't want them to see me. And so I spent the next 15 minutes trying to stuff cats into carriers. By the way, I have a whole new appreciation for herding cats. I put two in, one would jump out. But I got them all in carriers, all in the Sequoia. And I made a recording on the way out of the neighborhood. I said, look, I don't know if I'm going to get out because I'm the last one here and I can smell the smoke. And, you know, so I said, I just wanted to, you know, thank the people who agreed to take the cats. And I'm, by this point, I'm crying because they agreed to take the cats, 10 cats. We'll work it out. So acts of kindness always make me weep. So I'm crying. And then I start saying goodbye to people. Somebody said to me, afterwards, well, you could have burned to death. No. I've got a nickel plated 38 loaded with Federal Hydroshock hollow points. If the fire got that close to me, I'm riding that 38 out of town. I'm not going to burn to death. But I didn't know if we were going to get out. And so I'm telling my wife I love her, my sister I love her, my sister's husband, okay, he's a dick. Little humor at that moment, you know, I'm about to maybe die and I'm still cracking jokes, but we made it out. Thank goodness. But I drove back in because, you know, I thought if I'm going to die, I'm going to do it something amazing. Something, you know, people that the PETA people would build a statue to me. He went back in to rescue the kitties, you know?
So now we know that you are a hero to those who might be considering ending their lives, and you're a hero to those who rescue cats.
That is correct.
It's an award-winning day for you. But even within there, earlier on, you said something about feeling like there's no way out creates the only way out.
Yeah.
And often, again, that's true on so many levels. When people feel physically or psychologically trapped, that leaves them with only one option. And in the conversation we're having today, it is the worst option. And the one that you thankfully have dedicated yourself to helping so many people avoid. And I really appreciate you sharing that message with us today, because of all the tough conversations we work on preparing for and navigating and following up and building relationships through, suicide could likely be the toughest. Mental health could likely be the toughest, which makes conversations like these so important. Now, I know you got a busy day. You have other conversations lined up that you have to jump to. Before we go, please, two questions. Number one, let us know where people who want to connect with you, experience more of your speaking, training, and material, where they can connect with you, where they can find it. And number two, outside of the resources that you have already named for suicide prevention, what other suicide prevention resources should people familiarize themselves with?
Well, if they want to speak for a living, howtomakemoneyspeaking.com. I was struggling to find a URL for that business. And my wife, who knows nothing about the internet, said, well, why don't you just get howtomakemoneyspeaking.com? And I'm thinking, yeah, in 2024, that's available. Son of a bitch, it is available. So I bought it. The other one is Mental Health Comedian. Mentalhealthcomedian.com. That was a gift from a friend of mine
who
worked in marketing. He said, Frank, I got an idea for you, because I hadn't branded myself yet. He goes, how about this? You're the mental health comedian. Oh my God. I got chills. And that became my brand. So that's mentalhealthcomedian.com or howtomakemoneyspeaking.com if you want a TEDx, if you want to make money speaking. And the other question was?
Suicide prevention resources people should familiarize themselves with.
Yeah. And I didn't know about this until 2010 or 11. There's an outfit called NAMI, National Alliance Mental Illness, NAMI. They got a chapter in pretty much NAM, National Alliance Mental Illness, a chapter in most large counties and some small. And let's say you have a member of your family who has schizoaffective disorder. And I bumped into an insurance agent here in town who had a son who has that. And it was tearing the family apart. They discovered NAMI. And NAMI has a 12-week course for the family members of someone having, you know, someone who has schizoaffective disorder or depression or bipolar. And so, and they have family-to-family counseling. And so it saved their marriage, it saved their family. And here's the best part. Everything NAMI does is free. So I would, that's where I would start. If you have somebody in your family struggling or, you know, you, how do I help them? And then they help you. They teach you about the illness, what to say, what not say, what to do, what not do, how to find resources. And then the family to family, you realize it's not just your family. So you become part of a community. So I think that's my number one go-to.
Well, that will be in the show notes with the other links that you mentioned, 988, QPR, your links to your work as well. Thank you so much for taking the time today. I really appreciate you sharing your message with us. I'm very thankful that you can tell me what the barrel of a gun tastes like, but not a bullet. Thank you for stopping yourself short. But thank you for dedicating yourself. You found a way not just to be a comedian, but to teach people, but to make the world a better place and save lives, people and cats. And I truly appreciate it. Thank you so much. Frank, thank you for a very powerful, important, and occasionally humorous conversation. I really appreciate all that you took the time to share with us and our audience today. Your story is extremely powerful. It's truly authentic. And it gave us the opportunity to hopefully begin to have a window into what are people really feeling, thinking, experiencing when they are at the depths of despair and considering suicide. Unless somebody's been in that situation, it can be impossible to understand. It can be easy to accidentally convey judgment or to have meaningfully helpful efforts fall short and create more problems. So that the message that you had to share and the method that you choose to do it, adding in the humor, really means a lot and hopefully continues to save lives on top of the examples that you gave in our conversation. So first and foremost, thank you. I'm glad you're still with us. And I'm very glad that you're taking the time to help so many strangers around the country. Second, thank you for helping us understand what it feels like to be in that situation. And you mentioning that no way out actually leaves only one way out, I think is very important for us to think about and apply in many different conversations. And I'd never heard the phrase soul exhaustion before. To think about what somebody feels like when their soul feels exhausted and the impact that that has on their lives is very, very powerful. So thank you for all that you shared today, Frank. I truly appreciate it. And thank you to everybody who listened to this conversation. As difficult as it may be at times, hopefully you're now better educated, better prepared, and more ready and willing to intercede if you feel like somebody might be heading down a path of depression, mental health, or God forbid, suicide, to connect with them the right way soon enough to avert tragedy and help getting them back to a happy and fulfilling life. So thank you all for being here. As we ask, please take a minute, like the show, share the show, subscribe the show, tell us what you want to hear more or less of. We'd love to hear your feedback. Thank you for being here every week. Thank you for your support. Of course, head over to humantel.com. If you've ever thought about developing the skill set of being able to recognize shifts in somebody's facial expressions and body language and using that to help determine what they're likely thinking and feeling in the moment, then I highly encourage you to head over to humantel.com and enter the code INQUASIVE25 for 25% off their best-in-class training. For the professional interviewers in the room, head over to certifiedinterviewer.com. That's where you can learn more about the certified forensic interviewer designation. What does it take to qualify, prepare for, pass? What can it mean for your career? That's also where you can learn more about not what you just can get from the International Association of Interviewers, but what you can give, what you can provide, what you can share with the association as well. And while you're online, please head over to inquasive.com. That's where you can learn more about the customized programs our clients ask us to facilitate for their senior leaders, sales teams, negotiators, HR teams, and more to help teach them how to obtain the everyday confessions that are hiding in plain sight in their conversations by helping people save face, build rapport, and enhance their persuasive questioning techniques. We appreciate you being here week after week, show after show. Thank you so very much. Stay safe, take care of each other, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.